Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and this is our first lecture after the exam on Thursday. And I've recorded all the most of the grades in Blackboard. Somebody must have had their Scantron put back in the wrong pile or something. I forget who this was. I can't say your name. I know who you are, but since I'm recording, I don't want to say your name, so they probably have to see me right after class, so I can put your grade in Blackboard. And if you want to review the test, absolutely you should review the test. Come see me during office hours, right? And all the lectures are up to date, certainly because you had a test on everything. So today, the 28th of April, we're going to get into Chapter 14, Cardiac Output, Blood Flow, Blood Pressure. We got two lectures on this. Okay, so can't dally around too much. And what is your next test? All right, so three and a half weeks away. Okay, and we got these four chapters to cover. And, look, I don't have chapter 18 on there. Okay, there's no chapter 18 on there, so it's just the online material, okay, for chapter 18. All right, so that was a good question, and somebody mentioned something about 20. I'll look and see what I can tell you about 20, what happened to maybe a study guide or something like that. Okay, anybody have any questions? Yes.
So, you have to do the online quiz, but is that material
going to
be on the test?
For chapter 18?
Yeah.
It is not. It's not going to be on. It's going to be, okay, on exam 4, these are the chapters, 14, 16, 17, and 20. That will be on the last exam. Okay. All right. So even if I, of course this is a tentative schedule, but I probably won't change it. Right. So I'd just like to keep that as a good contract with you. Okay. Any other questions? We're pretty good. All right, let's get started with cardiac output, right? And then blood flow. And then blood pressure. Nice. And what do I want to do? I want to do that. Okay, cardiac output. Well, you know what cardiac means, right? What's cardiac? Your heart. And output just means the amount of blood that the heart pumps out, right? And so cardiac output is going to be calculated according to a couple things that we can measure, and that is every time the heart beats. Remember, the heart is not pumping blood continuously. Sometimes it pumps, sometimes it's relaxed. Sometimes it's contracting, sometimes it's relaxing, right? And every time the heart contracts, it's going to pump out a certain amount of blood, and that's what we call stroke volume. So when the heart beats one time, it pumps out a certain volume of blood, but if we want to know what the cardiac output is, we want to calculate what that output is maybe over a minute, not just for one pump, but over a minute. And we can count how many times the heart beats in a minute, right? What do we call that? That's heart rate or pulse rate, right? So then we would just multiply the heart rate times the stroke volume, and then we would get the volume of blood pumped out of the heart by each minute, right? Blood, stroke, cardiac output. I don't have units right here. Let's put some units right here. It would be milliliters per minute. Right, milliliters per minute. Let me get my arrow working since it's flaking out on me. Okay. Okay, so stroke volume, right, just the amount of blood that the heart pumps every time it beats times the heart rate. That determines the cardiac output. And cardiac output then is the flow of blood through the heart for what period of time? Flow of blood through the heart every minute. Yeah, right? So stroke volume times heart rate. And here's just a little tidbit for you. There's about 5.5 liters of blood volume in your body. That doesn't relate to much on this slide, but that's probably a pretty good thing to know something about. Okay. Well, here is a strange word that you've probably never seen before. It's chronotropy. And does anybody understand or can tell me what the root of this word is? Chrono? What is chrono? Chronometer, yeah, chronometer uses that root in the, it's a certain kind of instrument. What's a really common name for a chronometer? A watch, yeah, like a wristwatch, right? So chrono has something to do with time, right? And chronotropy then is something that can adjust the heart rate or cardiac rate. And the heart rate can change, right? So your heart can speed up, it can slow down, and you know that something about the nervous system. What nervous system goes to the heart? Autonomic nervous system. And what else can you tell me about autonomic nervous system? It's got two divisions, right? A relationship between those two divisions is? Okay, well, those are the names, right? Sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic? Yeah, they're antagonists to each other, right? Okay, in that sense, it's really, really true in terms of heart rate. And even without neuronal influences, the pacemaker of the heart, I think you had to know something about the pacemaker of the heart for that last test, right? The SA node will drive the heart at a rate of just whatever its natural rate of depolarization is. It is autorhythmic, and it will depolarize all by itself. And what the autonomic nervous system does is that it can speed up the rate, the heart rate, or it can slow it down, right? But it can't really stop it altogether because that SA node all by itself will depolarize. Right, so normally sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influence the heart rate, so we call that a chronotropic effect. And where in the heart does your body have this chronotropic effect? It's by acting on what part of the heart? The SA node in particular, right? All right, so remember you had to know a couple of different action potentials of a contractile cell as opposed to a nodal cell. So when we say SA node, put a picture in your mind of that action potential of a nodal cell, right? And it just repeats itself over and over and over again. Okay. So as a matter of fact, this is what I asked you to have a picture in your mind. Here is an action potential from a nodal cell. And here is let's look at the very top case. All right, so remember, there is no resting membrane potential. There is always going to be some kind of slow depolarization, and that's due to some special channels in the cell membrane of the SA node, and those are the HCN channels, right? Those are sodium channels that are pretty leaky, and as sodium leaks into the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? It slowly depolarizes, and then when it reaches threshold, then we have an action potential with a very rapid depolarization, and then repolarization gets back down, right, to a place that almost looks like resting membrane potential, but it doesn't stay there because those HCN channels, it starts to slowly depolarize again. When it reaches threshold, there's an action potential. And these action potentials are part of that excitation-contraction coupling mechanism, right? So if there's an action potential, then that's going to cause those muscle fibers to contract. Right? And so the nodal fibers control contraction of the contractile fibers inside the heart. So by adjusting the slope of this slow depolarization, then the SA node can either speed the heart up or slow the heart rate down. So if it speeds the heart rate up, for instance, if there is sympathetic influence on the SA node, maybe epinephrine, right, from the adrenal gland, or norepinephrine from the sympathetic nervous system, then the slope of this depolarization is going to change. And I think you know that sympathetic effect will speed the heart rate up. So what's going to happen to the slope of this slow depolarization? Will it get steeper? Will it go like that? Or will it get more shallow and go like that? Yeah, steeper, right? So more HCN channels will open up, so the rate of depolarization is faster, and that's what we see in this particular case, right? The rate of this normal depolarization is faster, so it reaches threshold sooner, right? The action potential is exactly the same, but this area right here lasts for a much shorter period of time before it reaches threshold. So in the top trace, we see that there are two heartbeats for this period of time. In this middle one, under sympathetic effects, there are three. That's for the same period of time, just because the slope has changed. Now, if the parasympathetic nervous system is going to take over, then the slope of this depolarization is going to become more shallow, and it's going to take a longer period of time to reach thresholds. So on this bottom trace, for that exact same period of time, there is only one action potential. And so we can see how the heart rate is adjusted by the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Right. Acetylcholine, right, is going to change the slope by opening some potassium channels. Right? And so what does a potassium channel do in terms of depolarization or hyperpolarization? Yeah, it's going to hyperpolarize, so it will work against that depolarization that's taking place with those HCN channels. All right, so here is a mechanism that is changing the heart rate, right? And what is the term that we use to describe heart rate or the effects of something on heart rate? Chronotropy, right? Chronotropy that has to do with heart rate. Well, I don't know if you've ever been experienced any kind of life-threatening situation. Like maybe you're driving down the freeway and you're passing between two semi-tractor trailers and then all of a sudden one decides to change lanes, right? And you're right in the middle and you got no place to go and you think you're going to get run over by a huge truck and there's no way out of it. You're sure you're going to die. But for some reason, you slammed on the brakes and you didn't get run over. Okay, you lived through it. What can you tell me about your heart? What's happening to your heart? It's beating a lot faster, right? But there's something else that's happening if you've ever experienced something like that. It is also like jumping out of your chest. Not only is it fast, but it's beating very vigorously to where it's almost feeling like it's going to jump right out of your chest. So there are two ways that your heart can be adjusted. One is by the rate, and the other is by force of contraction as well. Okay, so chronotropy, maybe I can go back to the previous slide. Chronotropy is going to regulate heart rate in this cardiac output equation, right? But force of contraction is going to regulate stroke volume. So both of those things, force of contraction and rate of the heart contraction, is going to determine what the cardiac output is. Oh, and how would you describe the relationship of cardiac output to stroke volume? If stroke volume goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up. If heart rate goes up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up. Yeah, so I would say this is a nice direct, right, they're directly related. If one goes up, if anything on the right-hand side of the equation goes up, then, of course, what's on the left has to go up because of that direct relationship. Okay. Okay, so chronotropy is regulating the rate, but we also want to know something about the force of contraction because that's what determines stroke volume. That is not chronotropy, that's what we call inotropy. Inotropy is dealing with or adjusting contractility or force of contraction. There is a cardioregulatory center. Your book calls it cardiac control center. I like to call it cardioregulatory center. This is in the medulla. Right, and this is the center that regulates the autonomic innervation of the heart. Sympathetic endings in the atria and the ventricles can increase the strength of contraction. Right, so not only is the rate going to increase, but the force of contraction is going to increase as well. So here's a table. Usually I don't go through tables very much, but this is a pretty important table to look at. It's going to show us something really important about the anatomy of the heart. All right, so what are some things we want to look at? Some nodal tissues, like the SA node. What's another way you should think of the SA node? It is the pacemaker of the heart, right? And the AV node, this is how depolarizations can leave the atria and get through that fibrous skeleton between the atria and ventricles. This is how electrical activity can enter the ventricles, right? So these two kind of work together. These are both nodal tissues, and then we have atrial muscle and ventricular muscle. So these are contractile fibers. So we're going to compare these four different regions on the heart with sympathetic stimulation and parasympathetic stimulation. All right, so for the SA node, we see that it increases, right, the rate of depolarization, that increases the cardiac rate, so that we could say that it has a positive chronotropic effect. Positive chronotropic effect, it means speeds up the heart rate. That's a really nice way of saying it. All right, and the parasympathetic nerves, well, have what kind of effect on chronotropy? Negative chronotropic effect. That says it all, right? You could read all this stuff, but a negative chronotropic effect, and so sympathetic is positive chronotropy, parasympathetic is negative, and you can see that there's nice antagonistic control of heart rate at the SA node. All right, sympathetic and parasympathetic fibers go to the AV node. I don't know where the FA node is. There's no such thing as FA node. Okay. And so the sympathetic innervation increases the rate of conduction through the AV node so that the ventricles will keep pace with the atria, and the parasympathetic innervation will decrease the rate of conduction. That's going to slow the heart rate down. So again, what's the effect of sympathetic effects on the AV node? Positive. What kind of effect? Positive. Chronotropic effect. Yeah, fantastic. And what's the effect of parasympathetic stimulation on the AV node? Negative chronotropic effect. Okay. All right, so you see that both sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves go to the SA node and AV node. All right, now here you have to, they have a total different world view. This is going to seem strange to you. So now you have some atrial muscles. So now we're talking about contractile fibers, not nodal fibers. Sympathetic effects on atrial muscle will increase the strength of contraction. What's a better way of saying that? A positive inotropic effect. It's going to have a positive inotropic effect. All right. And what about the parasympathetic? Is it going to have a positive or a negative inotropic effect on the strength of contraction of the atria? So this is weird. Okay. It says no significant effect. And you know the reason why? Is because the vagus doesn't go to atrial muscle. It only goes to the nodal fibers. So the parasympathetic nervous system cannot have any effect on the contractile fibers of the atria. Right? So it can't make them weaker, can't make them stronger in terms of inotropy. Right? So parasympathetic can only adjust chronotropy, cannot adjust inotropy. Same thing for ventricular muscle. Sympathetic effects increase strength of contraction. Right? So you would say sympathetic effects on the ventricular muscle is that it has a positive inotropic effect, right? But what about parasympathetic? There's no significant effect. And why is that? For the same reason as for atrial muscle, the ventricular muscle is not innervated by the parasympathetic nervous system. So the parasympathetic nervous system cannot have any kind of negative inotropic effect on ventricular muscle, right? So that's kind of strange because we really like to have antagonism, right, in a control system to have precise control and balance. All right, and then, you know what? After you live through that life-threatening situation, it might take you hours to have your heart rate go back down and have control of skeletal muscles and everything because, right, the parasympathetic nervous system can't be used to control inotropy because there is no parasympathetic nervous system going to the heart. All right, so that is pretty strange. So when we look at increased strength of contraction for these cases of sympathetic nerves, what effect do these have? These are inotropic effects and positive. What about the rate at the SA node and AV node, sympathetic effects? These are positive chronotropy, right? So, and we want to think of inotropy and chronotropy because we want to understand something about the flow of blood through the heart, which is a cardiac output. Right, so stroke volume has to do with inotropy of the heart, and heart rate has to do with chronotropy of the heart. I don't know what happened. All right, we're going to go back. Okay. All right, so let's look at that first variable in cardiac output, and that is stroke volume. And stroke volume is determined by the inotropy of the heart. So what are some things that determine the force of contraction? Well, end-diastolic volume. All right, so what is end-diastolic volume? Somebody should probably tell me in layman's terms, what is end-diastolic volume?
Right after the
AV valve closes. Okay, after the AV valve closes. I like that. That's pretty good. That's true. That's true. Yeah, I'm thinking of something a little bit more simpler, something like the way that you've stated it. The volume of blood that's in the heart, right, or ventricle at the end of diastole, and that's when that valve closes. Okay, and so it has to do with ventricular filling, right? So heart, remember diastole is when the heart contracts or when it's relaxed?
Relaxed.
When it's relaxed, right?
When the ventricles are filling.
Yeah, when the ventricles are filling, right at the end of that filling period, that's what we call the end diastolic volume. All right, so let's consider the heart is contracting, it squeezes down, that's systole, and then it relaxes, and you told me it's going to fill up with blood. What's going to happen to the volume of the ventricle when it fills up with blood? Yeah, it's going to get bigger and bigger. It's going to start to stretch out, right, as it fills up with blood. And how much it stresses out, it stretches out, is determined by that end-diastolic volume. And we're going to relate that to something pretty important in just a little bit. All right, so end-diastolic volume is important in adjusting what? Inotropy. Inotropy, right? The stroke volume. Total peripheral resistance. Resistance is just the impedance to blood flow in all of your body. So maybe you've done an experiment in lab where you took a tube of various diameters and put some fluid through it. And as the diameter of that tube gets smaller, the resistance increases, right? So less fluid can flow through that tube at the same pressure, right? Even though the pressure is the same, less fluid can flow through it because the resistance increases. That's maybe right now the best way to think of total peripheral resistance. It's just the resistance to flow through all of the blood vessels in your body. And then stroke volume is also related to contractility. That's the strength of ventricular contraction. That is what? That is inotropy of the heart. Right, so we got some of these things are, it's a little bit nonlinear because end-diastolic volume will change myocardial contractility, but this is a good way to think of stroke volume in terms of these three variables. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some of these in a little bit more detail. The end-diastolic volume is what we call the preload. So this is the load that's placed on a ventricle prior to contraction. And stroke volume is directly related to preload and contractility. What's going on there? So this is saying that if end-diastolic volume increases, what happens to contractility? It increases as well. Well, that's kind of handy. Right, as you're asking the heart to perform more work, what does it automatically do? It performs more work, which is really, really nice. That's what we call an intrinsic property of the heart. It doesn't require any innervation or hormones or any kind of stuff like that. That's just an intrinsic mechanism. So strength of contraction or inotropy varies directly with end diastolic volume, which also says that if the heart doesn't fill up, how does the heart contract? More strongly, more weakly, or the same? Okay, directly related to EDV. So if EDV goes down, what happens to contractility? It goes down as well, right? So that's not a good thing, right, under certain circumstances. Maybe you have suffered a hemorrhage and you're losing blood, which means less blood is going back to the heart and diastolic volume is going down. What happens to cardiac function as you are starting to hemorrhage? It decreases, right? Just the kind of the opposite thing that you would really want to happen. We'll look and see what's going on there. All right, so preload is just the end-diastolic volume. The total peripheral resistance, we call that afterload, because as the resistance increases, then it's harder for a ventricle to pump blood into an artery. Right, as this resistance increases, the pressure in arteries increase, and then, of course, the ventricle has to pump harder to get blood into that high-pressure blood vessel. So that impedes ejection from a ventricle. So we really would like to know, right, stroke volume and how it is relating to this end-diastolic volume. So stroke volume, that's a volume, right? Stroke volume is a volume. End-diastolic is a volume. So what this tells us, the ejection fraction, is how much blood in a ventricle is pumped, right, compared to the whole volume of the ventricle, right, before it pumps. So normally, because, well, the ventricle can't pump 100% of the blood that's in there. It normally pumps about 60%. So 40% of the volume of the ventricle stays inside the ventricle. Right, so this is a really good, useful tool. As the heart starts to fail, this ejection fraction starts to decrease. It can go to 55 and 50. And if you see that happening in a patient, what can you tell them or what do you know about their heart? 60, 55, 50. It is losing function. They're going into heart failure when that happens, right? And that heart failure could be due maybe to a leaky valve, an incompetent valve. And if somebody is concerned about, well, should we go in and repair that valve or replace that valve with a prosthetic valve or a human valve or a pig valve, which is, would you elect to have that surgery, say, tomorrow to have a valve replaced in your heart? That's not something you would look forward to, right? And so if you don't need it, then you wouldn't really want to go through that procedure. This ejection fraction will give you a handle on when it's important to do that. So if your ejection fraction is 60%, would you elect to have repair or replacement of a valve that's not working 100%? You would say no, because that's absolutely normal. But if your ejection fraction, okay, gets down to 45%, then guess what? Your heart is failing, you got to deal with that situation, and then, of course, you would have to have that valve replaced or repaired. So that's what we mean by a useful clinical diagnostic tool. It will tell us what the function of the heart is. And what is that ejection fraction? It is just the percentage of blood that's pumped out of the ventricle every time it beats, compared to the whole volume of the ventricle at the end of diastole. All right, well, we're kind of familiar with the length-tension relationship, right, of muscle. And can anybody remember the length-tension relationship of skeletal muscle? So I want to know what happens to a skeletal muscle as you start to stretch it. What happens to the force that it can generate? Does it stay the same when we stretch it? Okay. So remember, what are the filaments in a sarcomere have to do in order for a sarcomere to shorten? They've got to slide over each other, right? So there has to be overlap of actin and myosin. All right, so there is an optimal length that a sarcomere is that can generate the most tension. And if you pull it past that point, then tension can't develop, right? And if it's all the way slided over each other, right, then it can't contract anymore either. It can't develop tension. So here is a general relationship between stroke volume, which is what the force, you could consider that the force of contraction of the heart, versus how much the heart is stretched out, and you can measure that by the end diastolic volume. So this is stretching of the heart versus stroke volume. And so as the ventricle stretches out, the force of contraction gets stronger. Right? It's sort of directly related. We call that the Frank Starling law of the heart. And so what is happening here is now as the ventricle is stretching, there is a better and better overlap, more optimal overlap of actin and myosin, and the heart can produce more tension. It can produce more force. And we said that is just an intrinsic property of the heart. Right? And I see three different curves because the sympathetic nervous system can influence how the heart contracts, even at a particular end diastolic volume. With sympathetic influence, right, the heart gets stronger. If we increase sympathetic influence, the heart can beat even stronger, but nonetheless, right, as the ventricle stretches out, the force of contraction gets greater, right, under most circumstances, in a healthy heart. Right, so I want to show you this and then maybe do a drawing on the board. So this kind of describes, and you see a nice graphic on the right, Frank Starling law of the heart. I see three curves. I got tension versus milliseconds. So what I see right here is just a muscle twitch. Right? So we're measuring tension, not electrical activity, but muscle tension. And let's look at condition A. B, C, A. Oh, here's A. This looks like A, but that's not A. That's just an A band, right? So here is condition A. Now, what can you tell me about this sarcomere and overlapped of actin and myosin? Completely overlapped, right? And so we can't have sliding of the filaments. This sarcomere can generate very little tension, if any at all, right? And if we measure the tension that it produces, right, we see this curve right here. It produces just a little bit of a tension, and then it goes down. Well, let's stretch this sarcomere out, and I see condition B. Right? And so now I see that, right, this I band, now we have an I band so that the filaments can slide over each other, but just a little bit, but certainly a lot better than condition A. So can that muscle fiber produce more tension? We see it on the graph. Yeah, B produces a little bit more tension. Well, how about if we stretch the sarcomere out some more? All right, so now the I band is a little bit bigger. There's still plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, but the I band is still kind of small. And we cause that muscle fiber to contract, it can produce a lot more tension, right, because this I band is expanding compared to when there's just a little bit of an I band, certainly compared to when there's no I band whatsoever. Right? And then the last condition, the sarcomere is stretched out very nicely. There's still really good overlap between actin and myosin, but now look at this distance, the I band, the distance that the filaments can slide over each other. Right? It's very large compared to the previous conditions. And since the filaments can slide over to a greater degree or slide over each other to a greater degree, that muscle fiber can produce greater tension. All right, so when you look at stretching of this sarcomere, right, stretching a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, relate this to one of the functions of the heart, like either systole or diastole. What's happening when this sarcomere gets stretched out? Is that systole or diastole? Okay, when it goes, a sarcomere goes from a short length to a long length, diastole, right? And so what's happening during diastole? The heart is filling with blood, and that stretches out the sarcomeres. And as the sarcomeres get stretched out, what happens to force of contraction? It goes up, right, because it's directly related. Okay, so that's the Frank Starling law of the heart. I think I need to draw something on the board right now. Well, that's kind of the whole story, but not really the whole story. And it's really important for you to know the whole story because it's pretty easy to appreciate. All right, so let's just draw a graph. Ooh, nice dark line right here. Okay, so this is Frank Starling law. Hopefully you can read that. Frank Starling law of the heart. So what are we going to put on this graph right here? Tension. I like tension. Oh, let me do it like we're in a math class. Put a little arrow right there. Right. So here's tension. Increasing tension goes that way. And what's on the vertical axis over here? Okay. You know what I want to do? Go back to here. It is end diastolic volume, which is, do you have a sense of what end diastolic volume is on the heart? It is the amount of stretching of the ventricles, right? And so here we're going to put end diastolic volume. And in parentheses, maybe we'll just put stretch. And in your mind, when you think of stretch, what is happening to that sarcomere? Is it changing shape? Yeah, it's getting longer, right? It's changing the overlap between actin and myosin. So if the end diastolic volume is very low or zero, actin and myosin are completely overlapped, the sarcomere can't shorten anymore. So the tension is very low. As you start to stretch the sarcomere out, look what happens to tension. It increases. Right. And then if we continue to stretch the ventricle out, what happens to the overlap of actin and myosin? It decreases, 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 and then finally there's no overlap at all. That sarcomere can't produce any tension whatsoever. So the Frank Starling law has this ascending limb, but guess what? Also has a descending limb, like that. So here is the ascending limb of the Frank Starling law. Here is the descending limb. And a person could be in either one of these conditions. Right? So what could be happening here? Right? If end diastolic volume is really low, maybe somebody has had a hemorrhage. Right, maybe they lacerated a big blood vessel and they've lost a lot of blood. When you lose a lot of blood, okay, it can't go back to the heart and it can't stretch the ventricle out. So what happens to the heart, okay, when you lose a lot of blood? It gets weaker. And you lose more blood, what happens? It gets weaker. Right? So this kind of contributes to a shock condition that people go through. All right, so what would you like to do for somebody that's in this ascending limb? Right, if their heart starts to fail in this direction, what could you give them to get their heart function back? You could give them blood. You could give them any kind of volume that goes into their cardiovascular system. So you can't transfuse the patient in an ambulance going to a hospital. I don't think anybody can do that. But what can a EMT do to increase blood volume? Okay, they can. Yeah, they can start an IV and they can give a saline solution. Right? They can just give a water and salt solution, which is what? Isotonic. And so that water and salt goes into the blood vessels and diastolic volume goes up. So instead of losing heart function, what happens to heart function? Yeah, it supports heart function. Right? So that's important during hemorrhage. Right? Now what about this part? The descending limb, which means that the end diastolic volume is getting too big. So in this first case, we put volume in, how would we want to treat a patient over here on the descending limb of the Frank Starling? Take volume out, right? And probably not with a leech, not with bloodletting, but there's another interesting, very easy way to do this is with a diuretic, for instance, right? So a person will just pee a lot of water volume out of their body, and so this is heart failure, right? Because the heart is getting weaker and weaker and weaker due to a volume overload. The volume of the ventricle is way too big. Given a diuretic, right, the person loses a lot of volume in their blood. This end-diastolic volume starts to decrease. What happens to their heart function? It goes back up. All right, so this is all, so a diuretic is almost like a miracle drug. Somebody can come out of heart failure very fast with a diuretic because of this Frank Starling law right here. Okay? It won't happen in every particular case, but in a lot of cases, it can happen very quickly. So is this an intrinsic or extrinsic property of the heart? Intrinsic, because it only has to deal with the overlap of actin and myosin within a sarcomere. Okay? Okay, that's really important. Who's got a question? Anybody sort of get a glimpse of what I was talking about, maybe? I hope a little bit. Okay? Okay, so end-diastolic volume is just a way of understanding how much the ventricle is stretched out. And that relates to overlap of actin and myosin in terms of dealing with tension, right? Or, so if it's, so end-diastolic volume is adjusting, end-diastolic volume is adjusting what? Inotropy or chronotropy of the heart? Inotropy, force of contraction, right? It's end-diastolic volume is adjusting inotropy. That is the intrinsic Frank Starling law of the heart. Okay, extrinsic control. Extrinsic control has to do with maybe some neurotransmitters that are released by the autonomic nervous system, or epinephrine released by the adrenal glands that has an effect on the heart. So here we have a nice graph. Again, we have relative tension versus length of a muscle. Right? And as we stretch the muscle out, guess what happens to tension? Yeah, it increases because you get a more optimal overlap of actin and myosin. All right, so here we have, light green curve right here. This is how skeletal muscle behaves. As you stretch the skeletal muscle out, right, the force of contraction increases, but then when you start to stretch, overstretch it, okay, then the rate of increase of that tension decreases, and eventually then it won't produce any tension at all. Okay, these two curves right here have to do with the heart, and it is with and without epinephrine, right? And so we said that epinephrine is sympathetic, right? And is it going to have a positive or negative inotropic effect? Let's forget about chronotropy. We just want to consider inotropy, force of contraction, right? Because that's what we're looking at here. We're not looking at anything, positive, right? Okay, so where would positive be? Let's pick one end diastolic volume. Let's say right here, okay? At 80%, which muscle is going to contract with more strength? One with epinephrine or without? Okay, here is one without. Let's look at the tension. It's way down over here, maybe 10%. All right, with epinephrine at the same end-diastolic volume, where do you have to go? All the way up over here, which means what? Increase of tension, even at that same amount of stretching of the ventricle. Right now it's going to produce 30-35%, a big increase in force of contraction. So sympathetic effect on the heart, right, is definitely a noticeable and important positive inotropic effector on the heart. That's what you can see with these graphs right here. Now, what is happening with epinephrine and norepinephrine? It's due to increased calcium within sarcomeres. Right, because you know calcium is important. What does calcium have to bind to in the heart? Okay, I heard of calmodulin before. I know calmodulin is important in smooth muscle, but for cardiac muscle, it's troponin. That's right. So it reveals more binding sites for actin, and so that's how epinephrine works on the heart, increases calcium within the sarcomeres. That increases force of contraction. Yeah. Should I go back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, the reason between the skeletal muscle and the heart muscle.
Yeah.
When we just have the skeletal muscle, we enjoy the tension.
Yeah. As long as you don't overstretch a muscle.
Okay. That's in, the tension against all of
them. Only if you overstretch. On this graph right here, these graphs right here are on the ascending limb of the Frank-Starling curve. Okay? And normally, where people are about in this range over here. All right? So their heart can respond a little bit greater when it's asked to do a little bit more work. Okay? So, and these are all abnormal conditions. Right? And then this represents what? Overstretching of the heart. You don't see that on this graph here. You don't see overstretching.
But my question is, the reason between the skeletal and the cardiac...
Yeah, here and here, okay.
The amount of tension. Like, if like, for example, the skeleton muscle, if we, like, strain the more, the tension will be...
Skeletal muscle, when you start to stretch skeletal muscle out?
Yeah.
Guess what happens to tension?
The tension will be...
increasing.
More.
Yeah, will be... and athletes kind of know that, okay, because they like to stretch muscles. That gives them a better overlap of actin and myosin, makes that muscle stronger as a result. Yeah.
But for the heart, if we train more, the tension less.
No, here. If we stretch, what happens to tension if we stretch right here? It goes higher. Okay, and over here it goes higher, but here it goes higher faster because it's under the influence of epinephrine. Okay, so epinephrine has, the graph doesn't say it right here, but you should probably know. It has an inotropic effect, yeah, okay, big deal. But what kind of inotropic effect?
Positive,
yeah, positive. It increases inotropy of the heart. Okay, and since epinephrine comes from the adrenal gland, is that intrinsic control? It's extrinsic because that control is coming from outside the heart. It's not a property of the heart itself. Right, if you take that adrenal gland away, then that kind of control won't happen. Okay? Unlike the Frank Starling law of the heart. All right, so here is something that I'm going to have you draw in lab next week. Okay, cardiac output. Remember, cardiac output is directly related to... cardiac output is... it's going to have something to do with the heart. What is it going to have? What things on the heart are going to determine cardiac output? Yeah, the rate and the force of contraction, right? So cardiac output is the volume of blood the heart pumps out every minute, volume per minute. So how do you measure heart rate? How do you measure heart rate? So let's write down the dimensions. If it's not obvious, I'll put it down on the board, but maybe it will be obvious. What are the dimensions of cardiac rate or heart rate? Beats per minute. Yeah, write down beats per minute. Okay, and what about stroke volume? Stroke volume is milliliters per minute. I tell you what, it's not per minute, it's per beat. Yeah, milliliters per beat. What was over here? Beats per minute. This is volume per beat. What's going to cancel out? The beats will cancel out, right? And what are you left with? Milliliters per minute, which is the blood flow out of the heart. Did I write that down on the board?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, because it's a really important kind of equation. And I should know how to do it, so it should be fun for me. Okay. All right, so we got cardiac output. I'm just stuck over here on this side of the board. Cardiac output is what? The blood flow through the heart. And that is going to, flow is not a velocity, but it's a volume of blood. So it's going to be milliliters per minute. Let's do that, milliliters per minute. And cardiac output is going to be determined by both the inotropy and chronotropy of the heart. So in terms of the inotropy, what's the measure of inotropy of the heart? Stroke volume. And what is stroke volume? It's a... amount of the volume of blood every time the heart beats. Right? All right, but that's not cardiac output. I mean, it's directly related to cardiac output, but that's only inotropy. What else do we have to consider? Chronotropy. Right? So we're going to just multiply this by heart rate. I think your slide says cardiac rate or something. Yeah, cardiac. Same thing. Heart rate. And what is heart rate? Beats. per, and usually we want it in a minute. All right, so what happens? Does this milliliter cancel out with anything? Does not. What about this minutes? Does it cancel out with anything? Does not. But what does cancel out? Beats? Yeah. And so what are we left with then? We're left with milliliters per minute. And is that what we should have? Oh, that's nice. Okay, that's good. All right, so that's how I would look at that. So cardiac output is due to two important things, right? Inotropy and chronotropy. And it's pretty easy to measure these things. All right, so what's going to adjust? What's going to have an inotropic effect or a chronotropic effect? And guess what? They have heart rate first. So we want to talk about what thing first, inotropy or chronotropy? Chronotropy, all right. And so we said sympathetic nerves go to the nodal fibers on the heart, AV node, SA node. And sympathetic will increase the rate of depolarization of those nodal fibers. The heart rate is going to increase. Whenever you see an arrow on this diagram, it's going to have a positive effect. All right, so sympathetic nerves will increase heart rate. Parasympathetic nerves, do they go to the nodal fibers in the heart? Do parasympathetic nerves go to nodal parts of the heart, like the SA node, AV node? Ah, yeah, go back and look at that table. They do, right? And it will slow the heart rate down. It will slow the rate of conduction of those action potentials and also the frequency of action potentials generated by the SA node. So parasympathetic nerves have this nice dotted line showing that it has a negative chronotropic effect. That's part of cardiac output. What else do we got to consider? Stroke volume, which is force of contraction. So what about sympathetic innervation? If we stimulate the ventricles with sympathetic stimulation, what happens to the stroke volume? Even at a particular, just one end diastolic volume, it goes up. So we have a nice solid line, because it's going to stimulate, it's not going to inhibit. So what happens to force of contraction with sympathetic stimulation? It goes up. And if force of contraction increases, then the stroke volume increases. All right, then we got something over here, the Frank-Starling law, right? And is the Frank-Starling law, does that relate to sympathetic or parasympathetic nerves? Frank-Starling law. Okay, what I want you to do is group these two together in terms of what kind of control it has as opposed to the Frank-Starling law, the Frank-Starling mechanism. Okay, so is heart rate adjusted by something that's just inside of the heart or outside of the heart? Outside, yeah. Autonomic nervous system is coming from outside the heart, so what kind of control is that, intrinsic or extrinsic? Extrinsic, yeah. So here you have nice extrinsic. Now what about the Frank-Starling of the law of the heart? Does that require autonomic innervation?
No,
that is intrinsic, right, intrinsic regulation. All right, so the Frank-Starling law, if the end diastolic volume goes up, right, I see a nice solid line right here. What's the effect on stroke volume? It's positive. It will increase stroke volume, right, as it stretches out a little bit more. And here I see one last thing, mean arterial pressure. Right, so this is a pressure that's pushing on the walls of blood vessels, pushing on valves of the heart, right? So the pressure inside of the aorta is pressing all around. And what does the ventricle have to do in order to get blood into the aorta when it's high pressure? It's got to even develop more pressure to get blood to go into the aorta. Right, so as the mean arterial pressure increases, then the heart has a harder time pumping blood into the aorta, and that's why we see a nice dotted line right here. As pressure increases, stroke volume decreases because it's just harder to get blood into the aorta because it is such a high pressure. All right, so what do we call these things? All right, this pressure, mean arterial pressure, is what we call the afterload on the heart. The end diastolic volume is the preload on the heart. All right, so I'll send you a slide that's modified nicely like that. Right, so we got afterload and preload. And in the normal heart, increasing preload increases stroke volume. Normal heart, right? The afterload will decrease the stroke volume, and that it decreases cardiac output. Okay, so are you kind of compartmentalizing some of these things in terms of chronotropy and inotropy and some things that are really easy to measure? Okay. All right, so venous return is something that we want to think about because it's going to change the end diastolic volume of the heart. Right? Venous return is just the amount of blood returning to the heart, which means the ventricles, as the venous return increases, what happens to end diastolic volume? It increases, it gets stretched out, the contractility of the heart increases when venous return increases. All right, so venous return is just the return of blood to the heart via veins. That's what it says in this title. All right, and that controls end diastolic volume, right, which means that it stretches out the heart. And because of the Frank-Starling law of the heart, what happens to stroke volume as end diastolic volume goes up in the normal heart? Right, if end diastolic volume goes up, the heart gets stronger, right, in terms of force of contraction. So stroke volume increases, and if stroke volume increases, what happens to flow of blood through the heart? And we call that cardiac output, as we have over here, right? If we increase stroke volume because it's directly related to cardiac output, right, then cardiac output goes up as a result of what? Increasing venous return. All right, so what is venous return dependent on? Well, the blood volume and venous blood pressure, right? If we decrease blood volume, there's less venous return, and the heart is going to get weaker as a result of that. Vasoconstriction caused by sympathetic innervation of blood vessels. Venous return, oh, remember venous return is also due to a couple pumps, right? Like the respiratory pump and skeletal muscle pump will help return blood to the heart that will increase cardiac output, right? And oh, it says right here, intrathoracic pressure drop during inhalation. So the skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump, right, will increase venous return to the heart. So let's take a look at this graph. It probably says some important things. All right, venous return. What does venous return do? It increases end diastolic volume. In the normal heart, what happens to tension of the heart? Or that can be produced as end diastolic volume increases, it increases as well. Okay, so what are some things that can affect venous return? Well, blood volume. What can affect blood volume? Urine volume, right? And that's the reason why somebody might be given a diuretic. If we increase urine volume, that decreases blood volume. What happens to venous return? It decreases, right? And I guess maybe this is a good way to think of why a diuretic might be given to somebody with hypertension, right? Okay, so increasing urine volume, it decreases venous return, decreases end diastolic volume. What happens to contractility of the heart? It decreases, and that's going to result in decreased blood pressure, maybe hopefully bringing that back down to a normal range for somebody. Breathing, what does breathing do? Increases venous return. I see some nice solid lines right here. And as you increase venous return, the heart gets stronger because end diastolic volume gets bigger. Venous pressure. Remember, fluid can only flow from high pressure to low pressure. And what can increase venous pressure? Skeletal muscle pump, right? When a muscle contracts, it's going to compress veins, increasing the pressure in there. And also, okay, there is sympathetic innervation to veins, and it causes veins to vasoconstrict. Right, so think of a balloon, and if you press down on a balloon, what happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it go up or down, stay the same? It increases, right? So sympathetic innervation causes constriction of veins, and that increases the venous pressure, decreases the volume, that forces more blood back to the heart. And that increases end diastolic volume and force of contraction of the heart. So this is a pretty good concept map to know, but I'm not going to have you draw it in lab. All right, so here is a graph. This is just a pie diagram that shows where we have blood everywhere in our body. So where do we have most of our blood at any particular time. So not arteries, right? Not arterioles, but veins, right? And maybe even some large veins. So where does the sympathetic nervous system work? Mostly on these veins. By decreasing, right, the volume of these compartments will then increase blood going to other parts of your body. And so veins are not very muscular, right? They don't have a lot of elastic tissue, not a lot of connective tissue. So small changes in pressure in veins causes a large change in volume. As opposed to an artery, right, a small change in pressure will have hardly any effect on the volume of an artery because it's just not very compliant. So what in terms of everyday use is more compliant? Let's change the pressure in your tire on your car, maybe 1 psi, and then change the pressure in a balloon, 1 psi. Which volume is going to change more, the balloon or your car tire? The balloon, because it is more compliant, right? That's the thought of compliance. Right, so a car tire is not very compliant. You have to change the pressure a lot before its shape or volume changes, right? But a balloon, right, if you change the pressure by that same amount, it might change so much that it might even burst open, okay? Because a balloon is much more compliant because a balloon has very thin walls, just like these veins. Okay, so by changing venoconstriction, that's going to change end-diastolic volume and, right, the force of contraction on the heart. All right, so that's some pretty heavy-duty physiology. You're going to have to look at that, maybe read the chapter. Start with that equation over there. Think about this Frank Starling law. Maybe another way to get started thinking about that Frank Starling law, or another way to think about it in terms of blood pressure, okay, if we have a balloon and we want to increase pressure in that balloon, do we take air out or put air in? We got to put air in, right? So the same thing for our body. If we need to maintain blood pressure, do we take fluid out of our cardiovascular system or put fluid in? Put fluid in, right? But you got to really know the mechanism. The mechanism is because as we put fluid in, you have more end-diastolic volume, the ventricles stretch, they get stronger because of the Frank Starling law on the heart. All right, so we got to be really interested in blood volume and fluid volumes because that's what determines force of contraction of the heart and ultimately blood pressure, right? By adjusting these blood volumes. By taking air out of a balloon or putting air in a balloon, you can change the pressure inside that balloon. And of course, you need the proper pressure so that blood is going to flow through your body, right? That's the driving force. All right, so blood volume and thus blood pressure, blood volume and pressure are going to be directly related to each other, are controlled by three important hormones in your body. Okay, we saw the sympathetic nervous system is an extrinsic controller of the heart, but also the endocrine system is, right? So these hormones, right, will have what, an intrinsic or extrinsic effect on the heart? Extrinsic because they're coming from, do you know where these are coming from? Antidiuretic hormone, ADH, where's ADH coming from? You got tested on this just last week. From your pituitary. What pituitary? Yeah, you got posterior pituitary. Aldosterone, where does aldosterone come from? Yeah, adrenal cortex. Now here is something really strange. Atrial natriuretic hormone. Where is this coming from? Your atrium. And your atrium is part of your heart. Have you ever considered your heart an endocrine gland before?
Yeah.
And you have to because it secretes atrial natriuretic hormone. And what is this natriuretic? It seems awfully complicated. What is this natri here? Okay, natural. But have you ever heard of natrium on a periodic table? You have. What's the abbreviation for natrium on a periodic table? It is Na, and what's Na? Sodium. Right, so here's a hormone that is going to adjust sodium concentrations in your body. Okay, so we got to talk about some of these. All right, so a good question to answer as we talk about these hormones, which of the above hormones are synergistic right? And which are antagonistic with each other. And right now, we probably can't tell which one is which, but you got to know really soon. So which one you want to talk about first? Yeah, antidiuretic hormone. All right, let's talk about that one. Antidiuretic hormone has another name. I think we've talked about this before. The other name for antidiuretic hormone is vasopressin. All right, so one action of antidiuretic hormone is that it's going to have the opposite effect of a diuretic. What does a diuretic do? Makes you lose fluid volume in your body, right, by causing diuresis. Antidiuretic means you're going to retain water in your body. And think of that balloon once again, right? If you increase the amount of air in a balloon, what happens to pressure? It goes up, right? So antidiuretic hormone eventually is going to have an effect of increasing or maintaining blood pressure. There's something else. There's another action of ADH, right? It's called vasopressin. Vaso stands for blood vessel. Pressin means that it's going to cause constriction of a blood vessel, right? So think of that balloon once again, squeeze down on a balloon, what happens to the pressure? It increases, right? So if you cause venoconstriction or constriction of arterioles, that's going to increase blood pressure, right? So both the antidiuretic effect and the pressor effect will increase blood pressure due to ADH. Here it says right here, ADH released by the posterior pituitary, right? When it measures the saltiness of blood, right? And that, so you need an osmoreceptor to do that. High osmolality, which means what? High salt, right? ADH is released. Okay. And why might there be high osmolality? You've been drinking too many margaritas that have salt, right? Excess salt intake. Or, I say it like a bad thing. Sodium in the American diet is a bad thing, yes. Margaritas are a good thing. Hopefully they counteract each other. Okay. Excess salt intake or dehydration. You're not replacing fluids. All right, so excess salt intake or dehydration, that's going to have an effect because it's going to stimulate these osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus part of your brain. It's going to give you the sensation of thirst. And when you're thirsty, of course, you're going to drink, hopefully not salt water, but a nice water that isn't high in salt, and so that's going to decrease osmolality. Of course, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. It's also going to stimulate water resorption from urine. What does that mean? Water resorption from urine. Remember a nephron? Okay, and a nephron has got all these different tubules, and the fluid in a tubule is called filtrate. If it stays in that tubule, it ends up in the collecting duct, right? And then it's excreted from your body. But if it's resorbed, then it's going to go from the filtrate back into a capillary, like the peritubular capillaries, and then that goes back in your body. Okay, so that's a way of maintaining water in your body as a result of antidiuretic hormone, right? If you increase resorption of water from tubules, that is the antidiuretic effect of ADH. Right, and then ADH release is inhibited by low osmolality. So the reverse of that happens. So here's a concept map that I'm sure explains what we just talked about. So here we have the stimulus. A stimulus is going to always produce a response. Here I see a response, right? And then to know if it's negative or positive feedback, you just look at the relationship between the stimulus and response. If it's negative, they're going to oppose each other. If it's positive, they will enhance each other. So what are the stimuli? Dehydration, right, or salt ingestion, right? Dehydration decreases blood volume. That's going to make the blood more salty as you lose water, right, because you keep the same amount of salt inside that smaller volume of water. And that's going to stimulate the osmoreceptors. You got to know where they are in the hypothalamus. Is the hypothalamus connected to the posterior pituitary? Is the hypothalamus connected to the posterior pituitary? Yeah. Yes, it is, and so is the anterior, but different ways, right? Anterior is connected via the portal blood vessel, but the posterior pituitary is directly from tracts from cell bodies in the hypothalamus, going down through the infundibulum. right? And then the hypothalamus, of course, is right in the brain, and it can affect your sensation of thirst. Right, so as blood osmolality increases, what happens to thirst? Increases, right? That's going to cause some drinking. Drinking is going to have what effect on blood volume? It will go up, and as the volume of blood goes up, but the solutes stay the same, then the osmolality decreases. Well, what was the initial stimulus? The initial stimulus was increased blood osmolality. The response is decreased. So what kind of feedback mechanism is that? And there's a nice negative feedback mechanism. And what does that produce? What does that maintain? Homeostasis. Yeah, fantastic. All right. Well, that's not ADH. Let's talk about ADH. Right, as the osmol receptors in the hypothalamus are stimulated, it's going to send action potentials to the posterior pituitary, increase ADH secretion, and what's the effect of ADH? I see one. Water retention by the kidneys by causing water resorption from the filtrate back into peritubular capillaries. Okay, so that increases blood volume, decreases osmolality, and again, you can see that that response subtracts from the stimulus, so that's another nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so ADH, what is it doing in our body, ultimately? It doesn't say on this slide. It's adjusting blood volume. If you change the volume inside of a balloon, what are you changing in the balloon? The pressure, okay? So ADH is very important in adjusting blood pressure. And so what happens to blood pressure with ADH? Does it go up or does it go down? Increasing blood volume increases blood pressure, right? So ADH, so you got to make a note of that. ADH has the effect of increasing blood pressure. And we want to know what the effect of those other two hormones are to know if they're antagonistic to each other or synergistic. So what would you guess of those hormones? Do you think we will find any that are antagonistic to each other, or are they all going to be synergists? Okay, they should be antagonistic because what? Antagonism is important for precise control and balance. Right, so we got to press on just a little bit. Okay. I don't know if that clock is right. Oh, that clock is just way, way off in such a short period of time. I've got 12:28. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I know it's hard to know. I gotta have a chronometer. Okay. Okay, so that's ADH. What's another one? Here's another good one. Aldosterone, right? And that's a steroid hormone secreted from the adrenal cortex. And what causes secretion of aldosterone? It is ACTH. Right, from the anterior pituitary, and it helps maintain blood volume. If it helps maintain blood volume or increase blood volume, what's going to be the effect on blood pressure? It's going to increase blood pressure. So is that synergistic or antagonistic with ADH? It's synergistic. So yeah, write that down. ADH and aldosterone are synergistic on blood pressure, but let's take a look why. All right, so it's through resorption and retention of salt and water from urine. Salt and water. ADH is just water, but aldosterone is salt and water. So when is aldosterone released? Salt deprivation, low blood volume, and low blood pressure. These three stimuli right here will cause increase in aldosterone, and we're going to see that there's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right, to adjust all of these parameters. And this takes us to a really important control system. It's called the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Angiotensin is an active form of this hormone, and it's in your body all the time in the form of angiotensinogen. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? Ogen. Ogen is the key thing. Ogen means inactive, but it's ready to go to work at a moment's notice, right? So that's going to be in your body. Here's aldosterone. This is going to be started with an enzyme called renin. Okay, how does this go? Your book makes it seem really complicated, but most physiology books, it's not so complicated. So let's see if I can make it not so complicated. All right, here is an exam figure. This is the whole renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. And this is, the important thing about this is that this is the most important mechanism for controlling blood pressure in the long term. Long-term regulation of blood pressure is by the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So what do we mean by long-term? Long-term is like day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month. So when somebody has hypertension, which can be deadly, this is the system that is out of whack somehow. So it's got a number of steps, and that's really nice because any one of these steps can be manipulated with some kind of agent to help somebody with hypertension. So how does this start out? Well, let's start with low blood pressure. Low blood pressure or low blood flow to the kidneys, right? If pressure decreases, flow is going to decrease as well because pressure is that motive force for moving a fluid around. So we got low blood pressure in the kidneys, in particular that juxtaglomerular apparatus right at the beginning of a nephron, right, is going to release renin when blood pressure, what, decreases. So renin is an enzyme. It's released into the blood, and renin needs a substrate in order to work, and that substrate is angiotensinogen. So angio, just means like a vessel, like a blood vessel. Tension means probably increasing tension in this particular blood vessel. Ogen means that it is inactive, but it's always there. Renin can convert angiotensinogen into angiotensin, which is sort of an active form, right? But it's not the most active form. The most active form is angiotensin 2. And there is an enzyme that converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, and it's called angiotensin converting enzyme. Angiotensin converting enzyme. Nobody wants to say that, so we just say ACE. Right? So ACE will make the more potent form of angiotensin, which is angiotensin 2. And ACE is an enzyme that's found in the lungs and a little bit in the kidneys. Lungs and kidneys, that's a strange place to have this enzyme in the lungs. All right, but what's the effect of angiotensin 2? It has an effect of vasoconstriction on arterioles. And what's going to be the effect on blood pressure if we have vasoconstriction? It's going to go up. Right? What was the initial stimulus? Decreased blood pressure. All right, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. The second route is that angiotensin 2 can go to the adrenal cortex. What was that one hormone from the adrenal cortex that we were just talking about? Okay, aldosterone. ADH is from that posterior pituitary. Aldosterone will cause retention of salt and water by the kidneys, basically resorption. It's going to increase resorption of salt from the kidney tubules. And when salt moves across the kidney tubule, it's going to bring water along with it, okay, because of osmosis. And as water and salt are retained in your body, what happens to blood volume? It goes up, right? And as the volume goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It goes up as well. All right, so here we have increasing blood volume, right, that subtracts from decreased blood, This should be an arrow going over here to blood pressure, right? But it's still a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so why is this an important mechanism? What is it adjusting? Blood pressure, and in what time frame? A short period of time or a long period of time? Long period of time, that's right. So right now when you're sitting down and you stand up and your blood pressure drops and you might feel a little bit woozy, can this renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system prevent you from passing out because your blood pressure dropped? It cannot, because this is an endocrine control system, which is what? It takes longer to take an effect, but the duration of action is also longer, right? So short-term, immediate regulation of blood pressure, this system cannot regulate, only long-term. Hopefully this in bold says that. This system is the most important mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. Yes, this is true. Okay, so there is a disease that is epidemic in the United States, high blood pressure or hypertension, right? So how can this system be manipulated to maintain blood pressure in a proper range in what, short-term or long-term in an individual? Long-term, right, long-term. All right, so hypertension can be managed by a diuretic. Right, so what's the effect of a diuretic? What's it going to do on blood volume? Decrease blood volume. It's going to decrease blood pressure. That's always a good first choice physicians make to give somebody with hypertension. Okay, but that might not be enough. What about an ACE inhibitor? What's the effect of an ACE inhibitor? Where's ACE? Here's ACE, right? It converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And if we inhibit the production of angiotensin 2, then we don't increase blood volume or blood pressure. Yeah, just stays the same. ACE inhibitor. Maybe some of you have heard of ACE inhibitors. That's another drug. Okay, and then there is another class that are called ARBs. Right, they're angiotensin 2 receptor blockers. Right, so in order for angiotensin 2 to have an effect on the adrenal cortex, how does the adrenal cortex know that there is angiotensin 2 floating around? It's got to have a receptor. If you block that receptor, then you block this mechanism. What happens to blood volume? It goes down. What happens to blood pressure? It goes down. All right, so that's another kind of therapy. Beta blocker. And as a matter of fact, like a beta 1 blocker. This is the best one. I don't know if there's any pure beta 1 blockers, but a beta blocker is going to have an effect where? This is a beta adrenergic receptor. Okay. Do you remember any beta receptors? Sodium, potassium. I remember beta receptors in your heart. Right? And beta adrenergic receptors are excitatory on heart muscle. Increased force of contraction. Right? So as you block that increased force of contraction, what happens to force of contraction of the heart? It decreases. When contractility decreases, that will decrease blood pressure, right? So beta blockers is another mechanism. Calcium channel blockers might be another good mechanism. What is that going to do? Yeah, it's going to decrease force of contraction within the heart, right? Because it's going to keep calcium from binding to troponin, right? And that's going to just decrease contractility. So all of these things, I think you can get a pretty good sense of what's happening, especially if you learn this mechanism here. And then another very powerful one, alpha 2 agonists like clonidine. These are central receptors, and we haven't dealt with that because they can have a whole bunch of different kinds of effects that are really complicated. But this is a really good strategy. For instance, if somebody's blood pressure is 250 over 200, what could happen to that person? They could just explode, right, into a big bloody mess. Well, you don't want that person walking around or doing anything. Clonidine is a really good example of being able to just hammer their blood pressure back down into a normal range. Probably doesn't feel very good, I would guess. Okay, so under extreme circumstances. So all of these things are really good for managing hypertension, and somebody with hypertension might have to take a number of these medications, because if you make just one adjustment, there might be some other control mechanisms that compensate for that deficiency in the mechanism. So somebody with hypertension might have to take a diuretic, maybe a little bit of an ACE inhibitor and some ARB as well. And somebody with hypertension, it might take a year to figure out what the proper dose is, okay, for that particular individual. Well, here's the bad thing. When somebody has hypertension, they feel fine. They feel great. They feel energized. When their blood pressure goes back down to normal, which is good for them, they feel lethargic. They feel out of touch with things, right? So there's very low compliance, because when you're being treated properly, you feel lousy. When you're pathologic, you feel fine, right? So it's hard to get good compliance with blood pressure medication. So if you know anybody with hypertension, or you with hypertension in your family, you got to be really supportive, because they're probably trying to work out what the proper regimen is for them in terms of all these different kinds of anti-hypertension drugs. And if it's not treated, what can happen? Well, yeah, I mean, death, right, is the ultimate of this. So there can be vision changes, the kidneys are going to die, the heart's going to die. Actually, every blood vessel in your body eventually is going to fail. So hypertension is deadly. And it definitely has to be treated, and you just got to help people, right, be compliant with that. So if you have a loved one that's not taking their medication, can you say, walk up to them and say, you got to take your medication, otherwise you're going to die? I mean, that's true. You want them to know that, but what's going to happen to their blood pressure when you tell them that? not very effective way, right? So the blood pressure is going to increase, right? So you got to be really nice and gentle, but you got to make sure that it's treated, and you got to figure out what the proper regimen is. All right, so that's the importance of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. Renin from the kidney converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin. That gets converted into an active form by ACE, right? Angiotensin II then causes the release of aldosterone, which increases blood volume, increases blood pressure, right? So this is a way of increasing blood pressure. So how does this relate to antidiuretic hormone? Synergistic or antagonistic? Synergistic. So here we have two important control mechanisms that produce what? Normal tension or hypertension? Hypertension. Increasing blood volume increases blood pressure. Okay, so that's probably another reason why hypertension is really difficult to deal with. All right, so when we come back, we're going to talk about atrial natriuretic hormone, or peptide, that comes from the heart. So your heart is definitely an endocrine gland. The sign-in sheet is going around. So please sign the sign-in sheet. Here are your lights. Do you have an online assignment, I believe? Yeah, but it's not going to be on the test.
No, because I didn't know.